If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board, while Will Erskine booking the guests in the legendary CHML newsroom. Dave Woodard, here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. Lots going on. Doug Ford in Hamilton Today. With a check for $17.5 million for Hamilton hitting its housing target. There you go. Good job. Good job. And now, you know, I think that the federal government's getting a little uneasy that the province is getting all this attention. So said, well, we're going to pull back the province's money unless they hit their targets. So I don't know if everybody's hitting their targets. The province isn't going to either. Maybe not. So maybe if the feds cut off the money, nobody gets it. So it's so funny trying to watch people competing for attention here as one announcement is made. Another big announcement that was made is the capping of the temporary residents that are coming in to Canada. Of course, over a million people last year. This is between immigrants, temporary students, international students, temporary residents for work visas and such. So here it is, another self-inflicted problem that they're now trying to fix. Of course, the Immigration Department warned the Prime Minister 2 years ago that you're going to tax everything, whether it's the healthcare system, whether it's housing. You're going to create even more of a crisis by admitting too many people, and it just exhausts every service there is, from healthcare all the way down to housing, to sheltering. As a result, the Trudeau tents that we are now seeing, this certainly has contributed to that. And the Bank of Montreal said earlier, this will help bring down rents. That's what they're predicting. So anyway, the capping now of the temporary residents coming into Canada. So they're going to cap that self-inflicted wound. And this is after they just capped the situation in regard to international students, which, of course, created another situation with the universities and colleges. So it just keeps going on and on and on. And, you know, arriving at the fire with a garden hose or, a pail after the house has burnt to the ground, after they, of course, set it ablaze. The accelerator tax, another example. You know, we're going to do this. Oh, nope, too much. We're going to cut it back. Now, of course, the carbon tax. They carve out a piece for Atlantic Canada, but not for the rest of the country. So, and I guess with a carbon tax, there's just nothing left for the Prime Minister. But on and on and on we go. Sad news. Well, I shouldn't say sad, but certainly concerning news coming out of the royal family today. Lots of questions recently in and around Kate Middleton and where she's been, what she's doing. We, of course, know that she had abdominal surgery. Now we're finding out that Kate Middleton, in a video she released, says cancer was found during her abdominal surgery earlier this year, and she is undergoing preventative chemotherapy, she announced today. To talk more about all of this, Saad Salman with us, royal commentator, founder and editor of the Royal Watcher, and here now. Saad, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on today.
What can you tell us about the condition of Kate, her health?
So around 2 months ago in mid-January, the palace announced that Kate had a major abdominal surgery and she'd been out to Easter. However, the past couple of weeks, there's been quite a lot of unnecessary speculation on both social media and quite a lot of the traditional media sources as well. So this whole video and this message today was really as a response to all of that rabid speculation. Kate has said that the surgery she had in January, it went well. However, at the time, what they found that cancer had been present, and she has been advised to undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy and is now in the early stages of that treatment.
Again, I know, Saad, that information is quite limited, but are we to assume that they got all of the cancer?
We should assume right now that basically they have identified it and that treatment is ongoing. Because royal health is such a private matter, they probably won't release any more. It's kind of this is even more information than we've gotten for King Charles's cancer diagnosis. So the fact that they have done this is quite unprecedented in the first place. What she has done is asked for space and privacy at this time while she does complete this treatment.
And nothing on the type of cancer. We don't know anything more other than it's abdominal, which could be various things. Is that
exactly? Yes, they have not released any more details, and they're just saying that she's just focusing on making a full recovery.
Family, how are they doing? Reaction? She mentioned in her clip that obviously got to explain this all to the kids, and she said that she was going to be okay. What about the family?
So in the past couple of minutes, we've gotten a statement from King Charles that he is very proud of the Princess of Wales for her courage in speaking out as she did. And they were both in hospital together back in January, and he's remained in close contact with his beloved daughter-in-law throughout the past few weeks. And they've said that the King and Queen continue to offer their love and support to the whole family during this difficult time.
And do we know how long her treatment is going to last?
So the original statement that they did have the timeline of Easter. Now with this, there's no timeline given because they have to in the early stages of treatment and they don't really want any more speculation. I'd say that she will basically take her time to fully recover before she's back to full public duties.
Obviously, a lot of chatter on social media and in the media there in regard to all of this. Does this explain past questions and concerns that does it all make sense now for people, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, for the insiders, they had already known basically that she is going under, she's recovering from her surgery and she has really been taking the time off and she'll be off. But the speculation the past couple of weeks has been unprecedented and quite ridiculous in some ways. So for them, I would hope that this does kind of stop that in its tracks, but knowing kind of social media these days, I wouldn't be too surprised if they find some new angle to manipulate this.
We certainly know how the media and such, and now social media has characterized the royals and such. And we certainly know the allegations that were coming out. There was even words of an affair. Does this change the tone? Does it, come on. Do they look any more sheepish today as a result of all this?
Exactly. Yeah, I think this very much should put a stop to that, and especially the way that the speculation has been impacting her. And you can really see that she was, in a sense, forced to do this video as a response to that, because it has gone to an unbearable point where families are being damaged, especially innocent people who have no involvement in this and are just being dragged into this for social media clout.
And, obviously I have to ask this. Was the affair stuff, was that all just poppycock?
Yes, definitely. There's been no evidence of any affair, and it has very much been a rumor that began on social media. Those who began it have come out and said that it was all false and they were just making stuff up. But it has spread to a point where it's now uncontrollable, and the palace very much has a policy of not responding to this sort of thing. But we have been hearing stuff that the legal team of the other individual who was reportedly involved has been coming out and making legal kind of inquiries against, and their name being maligned any further.
So is this story over? What's next, other than she just continues on with treatment?
Yeah, I think at this point, this is very much the story. And hopefully the fact that she has made this statement and revealed this news means that the speculation can stop and she can basically be allowed to recover in peace without kind of any more attacks on her and her family and her marriage.
Unbelievable. Saad Salman with his Royal Commentary, founder and editor of The Royal Watcher. Kate Middleton, Princess of Wales, says that cancer was found during her abdominal surgery earlier this year and is undergoing preventive chemotherapy, but looks like in good shape moving forward. Saad, thank you for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you.
April 1st, of course, we've heard about the carbon tax increase. Of course, a vote of non-confidence yesterday, as there was one more kick at the can to try to get the government to change position on all of this. The House of Commons rejected that motion. Andrew Scheer is with us, House Leader of the Official Opposition, Member of Parliament for Regina, Saskatchewan, and with us now. Andrew, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Thanks. I hope you're doing well also.
Thanks for the time. Your thoughts before we get started on the carbon tax on Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. Obviously, we have a special coming up a little later on this afternoon and the funeral services Saturday. What are your thoughts right now?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I always believe that the measure of success for a politician in office is whether or not their opponents undo the changes that they made. And Brian Mulroney took over a country that was plagued with high inflation and high interest rates, a massive amount of government-owned businesses clogging up the free market, choking out productivity. And he privatized over 20 of these crown corporations. He brought in free trade. And despite many of his opponents promising to undo everything, of course, his legacy has stood to this day. So a very successful politician, a very grand statesman, someone who not only stood on the world stage tall to fight against our apartheid in South Africa, but was, you know, a meaningful partner in the fight against communism in the late 80s. And then as a person, just a phenomenal human being. You know, he's the type of guy that if you told him a year ago that your Uncle Joe was having a health issue, if he talked to you today, he'd say, you know, how's your Uncle Joe doing? Like, he would remember. He'd remember the things that were important to you, and not just in like a flattery sense or a transactional sense. He really did connect with people, and I'm going to miss him for that quality.
We talk about that era of politics. What can we learn from all of this? What can everybody in the House learn from all of this?
I believe if we all, you know, take a step back and remember that we're all human beings. When I was in the House of Commons, I had to, you know, make connections with members of different parties. And I believe that there's a lot of public discourse today dehumanizes political opponents or with. And I married into a family with a lot of NDP members. A lot of my in-laws, you know, traditionally voted NDP, and we'd have great conversations around the dinner table, and they'd say, you know, I didn't know that conservatives thought this, or I didn't know that's why they believed in X or Y. And I think that if we can incorporate a lot of a lot more of the humanity in politics, Canada would do better. And I know Brian Mulroney certainly did appreciate people on a very, very personal level. You know, made lasting relationships of people of all political stripes because he saw, I do believe he tried to see the good in everybody.
All right, let's talk about the carbon tax. Obviously, a vote of non-confidence yesterday. That was defeated between the NDP and the Liberals and such. We're also hearing news today that the Liberals are walking back their targets on temporary residents. And this after, of course, the Immigration Department said, hey, you're going to have troubles 2 years ago if this keeps accelerating. Now, we obviously, from a couple of weeks ago with the international student situation, we've seen them walk back the accelerator tax and even a carve-out for Atlantic Canada. Are you surprised they're still so stuck into this? It seems that it's like the only thing they really haven't walked back.
Yeah, you know, that's a great way of putting it because they have done big 180s or reversals on many other key policy areas. I should just point out that the escalator tax is still going up. Just, you know, they're trying to sell a slightly lower tax hike as a tax cut. I guess that's the best you can hope for with Liberals. But yeah, you know, on the carbon tax, every independent analysis from the Environment Commissioner to international rankings has shown that Canada is actually doing worse under Justin Trudeau than before. The Climate Change Performance Index just dropped Canada 4 full spots. We're now 64 out of 67 countries in the world. And you would think that given the pain that this is causing, the political backlash, 70% of Canadians are opposed to the carbon tax. 70% of premiers, 7 out of 10 provincial premiers, have called on Justin Trudeau to at least pause the hike and not raise it anymore. You would think that Liberals would acknowledge that it's not working on the environment, it's causing a big political backlash, and it's raising prices during a time when many Canadians are struggling. Yet Justin Trudeau seems to be almost pathologically obsessed with this carbon tax because he's ignoring all the evidence that it's, you know, it's not helping Canada achieve its greenhouse gas targets, and it's causing so much pain and misery with higher prices. So I can't explain it, but I certainly share the frustration of Canadians who don't want to pay higher taxes.
We keep hearing now from the liberals that they haven't done a good job of explaining it. It's a communications issue on their part. But, you know, I still get listeners sending me notes saying, can you tell me where the money goes and what this money is actually being used for? And you would think if you're trying and you got a comms issue and you're trying to explain things, that's maybe where you will start.
Yeah, I actually find that when the liberals say that, that it's actually pretty insulting to the intelligence of Canadians. You know, most people I talk to, certainly my neighbors, the people I interact with at my school, my kids' sports activities, they know exactly what they pay. They see the carbon tax on their heating bill. They see it when they fuel up. They understand the logic that if a farmer has to pay the tax and a trucker has to pay the tax and a grocery store has to pay the tax, that that's all going to lead to price increases, and they see whatever they get back in the rebate, and they just know it's not covering it. So I don't think this is a comms exercise. I think this is just the liberals are running against the common sense of the common people that you know, hardworking Canadians are logical, rational human beings that can see they pay more out than they get back, and they don't like it. And they could bring in the best marketers in the world. They bring in advertising guys from Nike or from Coca-Cola or from Hollywood, and it still won't convince Canadians that they're better off in paying a tax that gets sent to Ottawa and washed around the bureaucracy and spat back out to them and believe that they're better off.
I got to ask you, because I get this all the time. I see it all the time in the media. The Conservatives have no plan. And I've asked Pierre Poilievre about this, in which he stated. So I'll ask you, what is the Conservatives' plan? And is there a place to find this so we can send it to those that don't understand that you have one?
Yeah, well, as you know, in opposition parties, we unveil our plans a little bit closer to the election. That's very normal. You know, Justin Trudeau didn't table his platform until the election was called. But what I can tell you and your listeners is that our environmental plan will be based on incentives instead of punishments and rewarding technology and not taxes. So what Pierre has talked a lot about is the fact that you can innovate and encourage investments in research and development and new technologies. For example, under Justin Trudeau, Canada mines exactly 0 tons of lithium every year. Mining companies can't get permits to take the lithium out of the ground to make the batteries that displace conventional oil and gas. So by incentivizing and removing red tape, we can get more of the types of things that reduce emissions, more carbon capture. There was a project proposed to harness the power of ocean waves with a tidal energy project in Atlantic Canada, and it couldn't get past the regulatory red tape. So rather than punish Canadians with higher taxes, we can incentivize investments in innovation and research and get government out of the way to green light these projects that will lower emissions.
Andrew Scheer with us, House Leader, the official opposition member of Parliament for Regina, talking about the carbon tax, which goes up April 1st. Andrew, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you. You too. Enjoy the weekend.
We have talked about the growing encampment outside of City Hall that began as an act of protest earlier this week. Mayor Andrea Horvath met with the encampment protest organizer, Angela Voss, to talk about all of this. Angela Voss with us, property advocate, organizer of the encampment here now. Angela, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Yes, I'm doing great. Thank you.
So talk about this encampment. Give us a bit of a brief history here, how this all got started.
Well, when we started off, we started to protest because they voted for parking over housing in the Stoney Creek development. And, you know, that's just so many of the different projects that have been shut down this season alone. And it seems like every other town and city has gotten their tiny home projects, but we seem to be last in line.
Yeah, I hear you there. So tell us about the meeting with the mayor. What came about that? Because I remember we talked prior to that. You were hopeful.
She said, I'm doing great things that I know, but they didn't want the encampment to grow and they don't want to give us services. So I'm trying to take matters into my own hands because the care that we are providing for people has increased in such a way that I can't maintain the protocol of who I am and the care that we're giving without some extra measures.
So matter into own hands. So what does that mean?
Like bathrooms, somewhere for people with colostomy bags to have privacy to change those. People with Crohn's disease that can't find toilets in the middle of the night and have problems. Trying to give a holistic approach to some of those healthcare needs, as well as some of the wheelchair people that actually need assistance.
Okay, I'm just going to ask some questions and excuse my ignorance, but this is just for the general information. I'm playing devil's advocate here on, you know, on behalf of people listening and what have you. So who is in the encampments? Why are they not in a shelter? Answer that question, Angela.
They are in encampments and they are not in shelters because they do have different mental health disorders and different things that have happened that have triggered their trauma responses, and they have been kicked out of different shelters. Some of the shelters they don't feel welcome at, and they feel like they're being disrespected. So we've built a family and they really respect what we've done and the environment that I'm trying to create for them.
Why do you think we have this all of a sudden, Angela? Like before the pandemic, we didn't see people, and like this is going on all over the place, whether big city, small town, what have you, all across the country. Why do you think we're all of a sudden seeing this in a post-pandemic world we didn't before?
Because the housing, I mean, even for us to buy a home and to sell a house during the pandemic, the prices of the homes were crazy. We couldn't even find a home to buy, let alone to rent a place. We actually stayed in a trailer for a summer because we couldn't look at places properly. We couldn't find the type of property we were looking at. And every time we did, the property prices and the value just continued to escalate.
Is this encampment growing in size?
Yeah, we put up another 11 tents yesterday, but we also, one of those tents is a communal tent. It's Jordan's Life Wellness Center. So we are going to keep that one heated and so we can keep people warm when it gets really, really cold, because the last few nights have been getting cold and tonight's going to get worse.
What is the future of this, Angela? Where does this go? What's the goal now?
I'm working with a couple of churches. I'm also working with a bunch of different peer support groups to try to get it staffed on a continuum, because I can't do this forever. I mean, I've been down here for 4 weeks and have had two nights off. And I've been here 24 hours a day. So we got to get some staff. We got to get this going. And to be honest, I'm moving on to the next town because we can't allow these towns like Hamilton to stop us from having tiny homes and all these projects that are developed or perceived to be developed for the areas that are zoned for residential, not parking lots.
You said you've got to move on to other towns. Are you with an organization or a movement or something we can talk about?
I am with myself. My organization is Jordan's Life. It's in memory of my son that died 3.5, almost 4 years ago at Central East Correctional Center. So I'm trying to help all of those people that are falling through the cracks of society. I know my own other son had to move to Alberta because his chances of ever buying a home and living in an affordable life in Ontario was never going to happen. Hmm. So I have one child that's no longer alive because he had mental health issues and we could not support him where he was at. With COVID happening, his treatments and all of his services were canceled. And now my other son is in Alberta to be able to have an affordable life and to raise his family. And our other child is living in the basement of his grandparents' place because he too could never afford an apartment or a sustainable life.
Angela Boss with us, property advocate, organizer of the encampment that's going on at City Hall right now. Angela, thanks so much for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Good luck.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
A quick break here. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
All right, Dr. Sylvain Charlebois celebrating the 60th anniversary of poutine and its history. A great article he's written for The Sun. Let's bring him in. Dr. Sylvain Charlebois, Professor of Food Distribution and Policy, Director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie. And here now. Sylvain, thank you for the time. Dalhousie, whatever. How you doing, Sylvain?
Very good. When someone asks me to talk about poutine, I'm always in a good mood.
Yes. Well, I must admit, after reading the article, I got quite hungry. So before we get to that, I got an email from a lady named Barb from Belleville, and she's a frequent listener, and she knows that you're on the show quite a bit, and obviously is a fan of yours. And she said, "Hi, Scott, just read a tweet from the food professor at the National Observer is doing a profile on him, contacting people who disagree with him in an attempt to do a character hatchet job," and then goes on to offer her commentary. Do you want to comment on this at all? What is this?
Yeah, it's a bit weird that they contacted me before the holidays, telling me that they wanted to do a profile on me, and I accepted. So did the interview. But while I was doing the interview, it became pretty clear that it was all about destroying the work that we're doing on the carbon tax in particular. And you and I, we spoke about the carbon tax, and they clearly were in disagreement. And they did contact a lot of different folks that disagreed with our work. So I thought I felt incredibly uncomfortable and wasn't forewarned about their intent. So I backed off, but my understanding is that they still intend to publish a profile on me with a bunch of people, you know, being cited that are absolutely just against some of the work that we're doing on the carbon tax file in particular. Yeah.
So an article on you without you, sort of.
I guess, you know, the National Observer, to me, I actually started to read some of the work that they do. It's incredibly biased and one-sided. And so I encourage people to kind of look at some of the work that they do, but it's very predictable. I don't consider it as journalism, to be honest. I do think it's a bit of a propaganda machine for certain groups, if you will.
What is it
about that?
So what is it about, what view is it of yours that runs against their grain?
Well, I do question the carbon tax itself, and I do have some concerns about how the carbon tax is impacting our food industry's competitiveness. I mean, that's I think it's out there. I was never of the mind that the carbon tax is making food more expensive, because we can't really prove that right now. But I am concerned, talking to a lot of businesses, I am concerned how the carbon tax is impacting their competitiveness and how they can compete against imported foods in particular. So our food security obviously can be compromised by the carbon tax over time. And I think when you say that, well, to people like the people working at the National Observer, you quickly become a climate change denier, a skeptic, and I'm not. I mean, I do think that climate change is a serious issue. I just I'm not convinced that the carbon tax is the best way to go.
And I think the majority of Canadians hold the same view, but that's my opinion. All right, let's talk about poutine.
Let's talk about poutine. Yes.
How did this all start? How did it happen?
Well, I mean, Scott, I wrote a book about poutine, and I think I spoke about the book on your show 2-3 years ago. It's called Poutine Nation, and it basically the book is about, how did we create this dish in the first place? Well, how was it created, and how popular is it, and why can you find poutine anywhere in the world now? So that's what Poutine Nation is all about. And of course, I've been approached by the Quebec government to look into the heritage of poutine, and quickly figured out that poutine should perhaps be recognized by UNESCO as a immaterial world heritage, because UNESCO actually does recognize sites, geographical sites, and we all know some of them. Lunenburg in Nova Scotia right here is one of them. They actually do the same for dishes. The French baguette has been recognized by UNESCO. The hamburger from Hamburg was recognized. Chinese tea was also recognized. But we don't have yet a Canadian dish recognized by UNESCO. And I think that poutine probably would be the first, or should be the first.
So what do we know about the origin? How do you know it's 60 years old?
Well, it's 60 years old because in 1964, a guy by the name of Jean-Paul Roy, he was a professional associate. So he was a professional in sauces. And he was the first one to sell in 1964 in Drummondville at the restaurant. It still exists. It's called Le Roi Joseph, a poutine with all three ingredients, cheese curds, gravy, and fries. Now, the origin of poutine was actually came out of Warwick, which is about 50 kilometers away from Drummondville, back in 1957. The first time you ever saw the word poutine on a menu was back in 1957. But Fernand Lachance, the owner of that restaurant, hated gravy. He didn't like it. So he only sold cheese curds with fries. His wife came up with a sauce that was sold on the side in 1962, but it was only in 1964 that poutine was actually sold as the dish we know today.
And can anyone make it? Is there any trick to this?
Well, first of all, Canada has to ratify the deal with UNESCO, because we haven't ratified it. And I honestly, I don't know why. And that's why there's no Canadian dish on this list. And so that's the first step. And of course, we need a cause. And I think the cause should be poutine. Well, along with poutine, we can certainly add other dishes that has come out of Canada. Shepherd's pie, maybe? I don't know.
We could go on for a half hour on that.
Right, exactly.
But really the
premise is perhaps to sign the agreement with UNESCO and then actually have poutine. We actually been working on a proposal to be submitted to UNESCO, and it's almost ready to go. It's just a matter of having the government approve or ratify the agreement with UNESCO.
We need a referendum on this, Sylvain.
Exactly.
Dr. Sylvain Charlebois with us, Professor of Food Distribution Policy, Director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University. 60th anniversary of poutine. Sylvain, enjoy. I'm hungry now. Have a great weekend.
Have a nice weekend, too. Take care.
Lots to talk to Colin DeMello about, Queen's Park Bureau Chief for Global News. The premier in Hamilton today to award Hamilton the $17.5 million part of the Build Homes Faster Fund. And now we're hearing that maybe the government is in the Ontario government in danger of not meeting its own federal goals. We're going to talk about that and the 413. Colin DeMello with his Queen's Park Bureau Chief Global News here now. Colin, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with a housing announcement, Colin. Obviously, the premier in Hamilton today to make an announcement in regard to the Build Faster Fund. However, we're hearing stories from the feds that Ontario may not hit its goals of housing. Does that trickle down to all these other funds?
Well, no. I mean, you know, the federal government has been, you know, doling out funding to both provinces and municipalities for kind of trying to achieve some of the housing targets that the federal government has laid out, right? So, for instance, in Mississauga was in jeopardy of breaching its promise or commitments to the federal government to get money from this housing accelerator fund. But then Bonnie Crombie had come back to the city, had decided that she was going to impose fourplexes right across the city, and that qualified them for this housing accelerator fund. So the province is now being told by the federal government, well, listen, you too could be in jeopardy of not receiving some $353 million that's intended for affordable housing from the federal government. Now, that is not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things, because in government terms, you normally talk about billions, but you know, $350 million is nothing to sneeze at when you're talking about affordable housing and you're talking about housing construction. So what the federal housing minister is saying, they need, you know, better from Ontario. They need a better action plan for how they're going to achieve their targets. But a lot of this seems to be in the context of fourplexes and four units on a single property, which is what Premier Doug Ford has been raving about these last couple of days, or ranting about, I should say, these last couple of days. And that's what seems to have triggered this new letter from the federal government.
Ah, okay. So all starting to make sense now. All right, let's talk about 413. This was a project up around Vaughan, sort of paralleling the 407 for a portion anyway. What's the story behind this? Why are we hearing about this now? Because we heard that they were locking horns over this.
Yeah, so the 413 still has a long way to go. And one of the things it needs to do is do an environmental impact assessment. And so what the federal government did, because, you know, there are some oppositional forces between the federal Liberal government and the provincial conservative government, they decided to impose their own environmental assessment, basically saying, using the Federal Impact Assessment Act, they said the province has to meet the federal government standards for what qualifies for an environmental assessment. And if they do not or cannot, then the federal government won't let the project go ahead. It won't give it its federal blessing. Well, now the two seem to have come to some kind of an agreement behind the scenes. The provincial government and the federal government have both gone to the federal court, where Ottawa is essentially saying that it's going to pull back on its requirements and kind of hand over the environmental assessment process back to that province. So it really seems like a major hurdle in the building of 413 is starting to dissipate, which means that Doug Ford and the Ford government is a little bit closer to starting the construction of Highway 413.
Why do we think that the feds changed their mind on this or reversed their course?
I mean, there can be a number of factors. One of them being, you know, the federal government had a Supreme Court decision that didn't go their way. And this might be one of the reasons why they're now looking to back off of Highway 413. But also, look, Justin Trudeau is going to be going into an election campaign in 2025, and he doesn't necessarily want to be seen as being opposed to Doug Ford, who, for all intents and purposes, still has a lot of popularity in Ontario. So these two leaders, Doug Ford and Justin Trudeau, typically have a pretty good relationship now when it comes to funding projects, right? Trudeau is in Ontario every few months or so announcing billions of dollars for healthcare funding or infrastructure or whatever the case may be. There's a lot of money pouring in from the feds. So there might be some political maneuvering behind the scenes where, you know, the feds might say, okay, well, we'll give you Highway 413 if maybe you give us something else.
What is the relationship? You commented about the relationship between the prime minister and the premier. And again, we've seen them work together and many were surprised at all of that. And then the prime minister, the premier was quite vocal about carbon tax about a week ago or so. Has that strained relations in any way? Does that change anything or just different politics, different views?
No, I mean, the carbon pricing issue is one that's a longstanding gripe for Premier Doug Ford, right? I mean, he's been complaining about the carbon tax, as he calls it, since 2018, and that really hasn't changed. So the Trudeau government should and could expect, you know, a lot of criticism from the Ford government over this subject. But the relationship between the two seems to be an interesting one. Both seem to identify in each other that there is, you know, a sense of populism and some popularity. Both have also gone through similar arcs of scandal and, you know, losing some popularity. But both also realize that the best way to kind of get things done is to just work together and not be, you know, politically spiteful just because your politics don't align. So the two of them really have seemed to identify on like-minded projects. And then when they diverge, they aren't too critical of one another. I think that's the most important and revelatory point about their relationship. In fact, more can be said about Doug Ford's relationship with Pierre Poilievre, because those two don't like each other. Their teams don't like each other. And there is a lot of, you know, infighting and bickering between the federal conservatives and the provincial conservatives. You could say that Ford's progressive conservatives are more aligned with the federal liberals than they are the federal conservatives.
That's interesting. All right. So what's next for the 413? One hurdle cleared here. You said it's still a long process. What happens there?
Yeah, I mean, they still have to conduct and complete this environmental assessment process. And then it's a question of when they're going to be able to get shovels on the ground. They're probably going to want some kind of significant progress on it by 2026, which is the next provincial election. Remember, they ran on Highway 413 in the 2022 election, and they won a lot of seats in Mississauga and Brampton, really where this highway goes along. So they're going to want to show significant progress. But two major questions have yet to be answered. We don't know how long it's going to take. There is an estimate it could take a decade to build this highway. And we don't know how much it's going to cost. And that, too, it's estimated to cost them $10 billion. But the government has never been upfront about what the final costing is going to be.
All right, Colin DeMello with us, Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Global News. Make sure you're watching Global Tonight for more on all of this. As always, Colin, thanks so much for the time. Be well. Have a great weekend.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. The federal government is clamping down on the number of temporary residents coming to Canada. That will include migrant workers. And this is after already pausing the numbers coming in regard to international students, which all relates back to a couple of years ago when the immigration department said, you know, you got to watch some of these numbers are getting pretty high. You're going to stress all the systems, whether it's healthcare, whether it's shelter system, whether it's housing, what have you. And of course, continued on over a million Canadians, new Canadians coming in last year in various, whether it's immigration or temporary or students or such. And it has challenged the services as we have seen. So now we're seeing backtracking and a cap on the number of temporary residents coming in, as well as now international students. What does that mean to the system? Ravi Jain is with us. Jain, immigration law barrister and solicitor, attorney at law and co-president of the Canadian Immigration Lawyers Association, and here now. Ravi, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I'm very well, and it's always nice to talk to somebody from my hometown. So
there you go. We always love having having famous Hamiltonians back on. That's for sure. So, what is your thoughts on this, Ravi? First blush.
Well, first I should say I'm now the past co-president of the Canadian Immigration Law Association. So I finished my term there. My thoughts, I think that this was inevitable. The government has dramatically increased the number of temporary residents, and those, of course, include international students, but also people here on work permits. I often have to sort of backtrack to, because I realize not everyone understands these terms of art, right? I mean, you can be here in temporary resident status, and then the next step is permanent resident, sort of like what the Americans call a green card, and then the final step is citizenship. So what we're talking about right now are the number of temporary residents, because the number of permanent residents, which we typically refer to as immigrants, that has hovered around 1% of the population. What's changed is that the temporary residents have gone through the roof. There were 6.2% of the population in 2023. So that's a huge increase. And what the minister is talking about is trying to get them down to about 5% in 2027, which will still be a lot more than sort of the percentage of the population that are permanent residents.
So how did we get here? I mean, as I mentioned, I read that the immigration department talked about this a couple of years ago. It's, you got to tap the brakes. It's a little too heavy. You're going to tax systems. How do we get here?
Well, I mean, I think there's been a lot of analysis on the student side, right? I mean, I think the issues were that the provinces weren't controlling the number of, well, they weren't controlling the colleges properly because they weren't giving enough money to the educational institutions, and they were capping the tuition rates that the schools could charge. So they were kind of starved for cash. And then they realized the numbers, you know, in terms of the dollars coming in with international students. So it wasn't hard to figure out that they would, to survive, they would sort of lean heavy on international students. So that sort of explains the international students. In terms of the number of foreign workers, which, you know, I don't want to get too complicated here, but I'll just say the number of people on work permits, because there's a temporary foreign worker program, which, you know, the government defines as foreign workers, but really there's lots of other people who come on, outside of the temporary foreign worker program, which is the one where you need to go to the Department of Labor to get what we call a labor market impact assessment. There's lots of others. And some of those, I mean, the minister is going to have a hard time, you know, really shaving the numbers on, if you look at the fact that some of them are governed by international treaties, right? So those, I think it'll be trickier for him to bring down the numbers, but I think we're going to see in the temporary foreign worker program, which is the one, as I said, that you have to go to the Department of Labor, and typically you've got to advertise for a month, three different sources, and you've got to show that Canadians are not available and that there's at least a neutral impact, and certainly not a negative impact on the labor market. So there's about 9% of that number are coming in under that program. So that we were already seeing the ministers talking about introducing a cap In terms of
so again, yeah. Ravi, getting back to my initial question, whether it's the universities or whether it's international students or temporary workers or such, at the end, and whatever the reasons are that, you know, institutions, whatever, want more money, at the end of the day, it's the immigration system that lets these people in. It's the government that lets people in. Why did they let that get so high? Could they not see this coming?
Well, again, it relates to the fact that the provinces are the ones that control, if you think about it, I mean, constitutionally, provinces control education. So the provinces controlled, which institutions were designated for the federal government to then issue visas on. It's just the federal government certainly lost sight of things. They were just printing visas, right?
I think, Ravi, at the end of the day, I think that's the point that people are trying to make here, is that the federal government lost sight of things, and now we're taking it out on the provincial governments or the educational system that tried to take advantage of it. Whereas at the end of the day, how do we get to this point in the first place?
I think it was both levels. I think the provinces certainly were letting all kinds of educational institutions be designated, that which shouldn't have been, like some of the private colleges. So for sure they lost sight of things, but the federal government too, I mean, they know the numbers that were coming in and they did nothing to stop it. So, you know, they were just focused on the fact that it's a $23 billion industry, and there were, you know, everyone was going on and on about how great that was. I mean, I started writing about some of the challenges students were having, like the high suicides and other sort of challenges about a couple of years ago. But I mean, I think, I think that they were just sort of enamored with the fact that it was, you know, it was a bigger industry for Canada than lumber, right? So this is the kind of stuff that they were selling. They were saying, well, look, isn't this great? International students want to come here, that we're competing with Australia and the US, but we forgot about housing. The federal government forgot about those, the challenges the students themselves were facing and the exorbitant costs that they were paying and the sacrifices they were making to do that. And, you know, we turned a blind eye because the big box stores and others, you know, look at Uber Eats and those kinds of things. They were relying on that kind of labor. So now I think they're going to have to, you know, obviously they're capping the students, and now they're looking at foreign workers and saying, we got to cap them too. And they're going to go and proceed and do that. I mean, it's going to take them some years to do it, because I think the minister is giving himself some wiggle room in terms of bringing the numbers down by 2027. We're in 2024. Like, why is he taking 3 years to do this? I think it's because it's going to be tricky to figure out, because a lot of companies say, we just desperately need these certain foreign workers. They're critical to our company and they keep us afloat. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Ravi Jain with us, Jain Immigration Law Barristers and Solicitors, and past co-president of the Canadian Immigration Lawyers Association. Ravi, thank you so much for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
You too. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. It comes from Steve on, where are the advocates for the carbon tax? If the carbon tax is so necessary, why don't we hear more people on the last word preaching its terrific benefits? Because, Steve, I have driven them all away. As ever, keep right except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.